you have to expose yourself a little bit. You'll get found out if you don't. If you wait until it's all ready to go, when you eventually do make it to market and you realize that all these customers actually need something slightly different to what you've actually built.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to season 11 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, we're in Cork. We're recording in the beautiful new iconic offices building for our first ever recording outside of Dublin. We've come down here to chat to Joe and John from WorkVivo. They have started one of the biggest success stories of Irish tech companies in the last 10 years. They have an incredibly unusual story. They started their business with no idea what the business was going to be. This is a story that is going to give you the templates and frameworks to start your own business, no matter what that is. Quick shout out to my sponsor, Sage. Sage is the number one provider of payroll, finance, and HR software to small and medium-sized enterprises all across the globe. Find out more about Sage, click the link in the description below. Now, let's get straight into my chat with John and Joe from WorkVivo. John and Joe, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Gary.
Very slick new surroundings we find ourselves in. We're not used to such luxurious surroundings for the new iconic building here in Cork, so we had to come down just to see you two.
Thanks very much. No, it's gorgeous. It's it's pretty slick, nice, intimate setting here, but no, lovely. No, great to be here.
So people will know you from WorkVivo. But the question I had is, why co-founders?
Why co-founders? Maybe I might start with our story or why we got together.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a little bit unorthodox, fair to say, Joe, right? So Joe and I had worked together in a company called Core HR. Joe was CTO there. I was ultimately CEO there. We got to know each other, got to know each other's capabilities. Fast forward a few years and I had left Core HR, Joe was off doing something different. And literally we got together for a few cups of coffee, talked about starting a company. And we committed to starting a company before we knew what we were going to build, which is a very unusual way to go about things. People normally think, yeah, you've got this burning idea, you're waiting for years to just get the opportunity to build. That wasn't our story. Our story was, yeah, let's commit to starting a company. I think... for me, I knew what Joe's capability was. I've described Joe before as a once in a generation technology guy. And for me, if I was ever going to start a company, it was going to be with Joe. And we started, and you know, first month was trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to build, right? Or it was first 2 months actually, and we started with we were just chatting earlier with like looking at loyalty, a la kind of Squid. And then we started looking at recruitment, and then we figured out, no, it's not really for us. But we had actually made a little bit of ground on recruitment. But this is all in the first 8 weeks. And then once we started looking at engagement, communication, we just found we were passionate on that. But I think it goes back to why co-founders. For me, I had huge respect for Joe based on working with him in Core HR. And I just felt, okay, we did not know what we were going to build. But I had confidence that, you know, we have very different skill sets. And just for me, I felt confident it was a good fit.
I love that story. You've started strong there with that. We didn't know what we were going to build, but we were going to start a company. Because everyone's always looking for, like, what's the blueprint? What's the answer? There must be one way to start. And there's a million ways. Every single guest I've had on has had a different way. Some bootstrap, some venture. Some would never bootstrap. Some would never venture. Okay, was this something you talked about a good few times? Was this something when you were in Core that you're like, oh, one day we're going to do this? You know, what was, because that is a very unconventional way to start, and I love it.
I don't think when we were in Core, we ever talked about starting a business together, but I think we obviously built up a very strong relationship and a very, you know, as John put it, a very strong respect for one another. And I think that kind of comes back to that why co-founder, right? It's, if you're a solo founder, it can be very difficult to be able to do everything that you need to do to start a company and to be successful at it. And, you know, I've been part of companies since Core HR where I've kind of seen firsthand just how challenging that can be. And, you know, I think, you know, John mentioned that kind of mutual respect. Like for me, like when we were starting the company, I knew that by working with John that we were going to have, you know, an exponentially larger chance of being successful. And I knew that because I knew that John would complement exactly the gaps that I had within my own skill set. So like one of the things that, like, I would say, like, straight off the bat is that John is an incredibly positive person. And, you know, I think if you asked anybody who works at WorkVivo today, you know, all the people, regardless of where they're based, I think the one thing that, if you ask them for one word about John, I think they'd say positive. You know, John builds on positive energy. He's a very positive outlook on things. I'm a more logical person. I'm a techie.
I was loving to see how you're going to frame this.
No, like, I mean, I tend to, like, look at all the scenarios, and a lot of them are, you know, things could go wrong. Things can be negative. John always frames things into positive from the start. And, like, I get an energy off that. And I find it, you know, it really helps me. So that's kind of how, I suppose, it kind of came to be. I think, like, interesting in terms of, like, the founding journey, like, for us, I had actually been part of a couple of startups before we started WorkVivo. So I had kind of gotten an opportunity to see exactly what I didn't want to do. I knew I didn't want to be a CEO, for example. I'd been there, done that, and found that it wasn't, it didn't really work for me. I knew that I needed somebody who had the skills that John has to be successful. And, you know, we'd had such a strong relationship at our time in Core that when we kind of synced back up, we'd obviously kept in touch over the years, of course. But when we synced back up, it was, you know, there was just an instant energy there that I think both of us latched onto. And it didn't really matter what we built. We just knew that if we combined, you know, that energy, we would do something that would be meaningful. In terms of the journey and, like, the approach that we've taken, like, early on, like, we didn't really talk about, do we bootstrap, do we go and fundraise, do we get investment, all of that kind of thing. We focus more on, like, what do we want to get out of this? We want to have a laugh. We want to enjoy this. We want to get up in the morning and feel like we're having fun, we're doing something we love, you know, we're in a fortunate enough position that we can do that. So why wouldn't we?
So you started with the end in mind almost.
We started with the end in mind. And I think at the very start, the end was actually probably, like, not less ambitious, but, like, it was probably less maybe grand than our vision for WorkVivo is now. You know, I think we both wanted to work together. We wanted to have fun. We wanted to build something meaningful. We wanted to, you know, do something that would create a very good life for ourselves and all of that kind of thing, and for the people who became part of the business. But I think the kind of the big ambition came much later. At the start, it was more about creating a great company.
That's really interesting, because a lot of people get fixated on that. Oh, you're not thinking big enough. You're not going to make it. I hate this phrase. Make a dent in the universe. Everyone feels they need to have that day one. Mm. So I want to explore that idea of the two of you just kind of coming together and going, right, let's do something. Because that's always the other question is, like, oh, when is the time right? How will I know? So how did you know that this unconventional way was the way forward?
I think, like, when we got together, it was probably timing as well, right? So timing had played into it. I had, like, Core HR had been acquired. It was 12 months after that I stepped away. So I was enjoying a little bit of time off at the time. I think it was a very opportune moment for Joe as well. So I think, you know, we could have talked about starting a company 12 months prior, but I just don't think the timing would have been right. So I think it was timing. It was timing. And it's funny, you know, when you're starting a company, because I think a lot of people put themselves under pressure in terms of, if you're going to start a company, you have to have this amazing idea that nobody has ever thought of before. And for us, we didn't put ourselves under that pressure. I think, like, we wrote down a lot of, like, criteria or prereqs for anything we were going to start or build. And one of them was, you know, it had to be like a SaaS, like that. It was obviously going to be a SaaS software company. That was our expertise. It was probably going to be in the greater HR space. So we started writing these things down. But one thing we wrote down was that there had to be pre-existing competition. And like that's kind of feels counterintuitive to a lot of people, where it's like, why would you jump into a space where there's competition? But for us, it's, well, there's a market there, right? There's a validated market. If there's competition, it means there are buyers in that market. And for us, then it's like, okay, if you jump in, or if we jump in, we felt confident that we would do things a little bit differently, a little bit better, have a different angle on it. And I think once you're in, and if you win that first customer or that second customer, customers will lead you in a certain direction anyway, and it's about listening to it. And but we literally just, like, jumped in, didn't worry about that there's this competition in this kind of wider space. And it kind of evolved from there. But one thing we always talk about as well is, like, some people have this like grand ambition to, hey, we want to go public by this date, or and we've never had that, not because we're not ambitious, like we're savagely ambitious, but it's always been just about like realizing our potential. And let's realize our potential, do all the right things, and see where it gets us. Because I think if you predefine the outcome has to be this, then is it a case then that anything other than that is a failure? And I don't think either of us buy into that. So for us, it's about, okay, let's enjoy the journey. Let's just realize our potential, do all the right things to realize our potential. And a lot of good things kind of happen by taking that approach.
Yeah, you can lose focus on all the open doors. You're walking by all these open doors of opportunity when you're like, no, I have to get through that window at the bottom of the corridor. That's the only way. Talk to me about the process of the day one. You're like, right, new company, here we go. What do you do today, lads? Oh, we're going in to figure out what our new company is going to do. Bring me back to that day, because I'm really interested in that whole process of like day one, right?
Yeah, I've mentioned before, actually, there's a great phrase that I suppose we have in Ireland, right? Which is, it's kind of a, should God love us? And I think that's the phrase my wife would have used when she saw me going out to work every day, to work, inverted commas. It's like, so you don't know what you're building, but you've started a company with Joe, but you've no idea what you're doing.
And you're not going to be here all day.
Yeah. So you're at work, inverted commas. And there's we always talk about, you know, the full Monty, where there's a guy that goes off pretending to go to work every day with the briefcase.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit of that. It was like turning up for work with Joe, and it's, you know, hey, Joe, did you have any ideas last night? You know, I had this. What ideas did you have? I had this idea. Would this work? Let's. And it was literally like turning up with blank page. What about loyalty? What about recruitment? That's okay. Recruitment sounds good. Let's build a prototype on. And it was just a lot of like trial and error, but it was literally 2 months of trying to figure out and turning up for work with what are we going to work on?
It's exciting, but scary, I'd imagine.
I don't think it was scary. I think we knew that, like there's a scientific approach you can take to it as well, where you go, I remember talking to Peter Coppinger from Teamwork on this, where, you know, you just look at the hottest startups that exist on the planet. Who's growing fastest? What are they doing? Okay, let's jump into that, right? And try and do it better, or try and do it faster, or, you know, have some sort of differentiation. So I think we knew we would get to a good place in terms of like figuring out what the product was. But it took us 2 months. Maybe we thought we'd do it in a week, right? Which we didn't. But
2 months still seems short.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, we joke with that sometimes that we had a pivot. But I don't think you can call it a pivot when it was only, we probably invested like 6 weeks on of, you know, development time and design time on the recruitment solution. But
so how did you go from whiteboard to action? Like how, because I think that's the bit that catches a lot of people. They have the whiteboard and it's like, looks like a murderer's map of how they're going to do all this stuff. How did you go from that to actually going, right, action here? Let's make some things happen.
For me, it was probably like securing a customer. And I think that's like, we always talk about, you know, don't get too caught up in investment process, focus on winning a customer, right? Because that's the best source of capital you're going to get. So for us, when we had the recruitment idea, we approached Morgan McKinley, Brian Murphy in there, Pat Fitzgerald was CEO at the time, and we brought them this idea that we had around recruitment, and it was actually a pretty good idea, and they really liked it, and they were like keen to work with us, and like we started a great relationship with them. We met a lot of their senior guys, and over the next few weeks, we started figuring out that it wasn't really for us. I think we could have built a really good product there. But I had to go back to Pat and say, hey, Pat, look, we've actually changed our minds. We're not going to build a recruitment solution. Here's what we're thinking of building. And when I explained to Pat what we were thinking of building, he really liked that idea as well. And he said, look, let me introduce you to my HR director, Helen Gallagher. And we started a relationship with Morgan McKinley that ultimately allowed us validate what we were thinking, validate designs. And then it became just naturally very action-based, because we're meeting a potential customer. We've got a meeting in the diary for next week. What are we going to be able to show? We've got to do design work, dev work for next Wednesday. Once we met them, there was follow-up. We'd have to have something ready again for the, you know, 2 weeks later.
How do you get a customer with no product, though?
And a story is always something that we've, I think, been reasonably strong on, in terms of, like, you can, if you have an idea about what you want to build, I think you can tell the story of what it's going to do without actually having a final product. And, you know, you can use graphics, prototypes, imagery, but I think people buy into a story. And we told a good story about what we wanted to build, because we knew at a high level what it was, what we wanted to do. And it was enough that Morgan McKinley bought into that and really liked it. And then it was about, like, executing and building those component parts. And it was similar with Staffordshire University in the UK. They similarly bought into the story we told around what we wanted to build. And I think once you have that, and we had that very early on, they both strongly bought into it. Then we almost had, like, early deliverables. So like before we had any product, we had deliverables. We had deliverables to customers, our potential customers. And it was, we made commitments, say, hey, do you mind if we come back in 2 weeks? We'll show you where we got to based on what we've talked about. And it just, I think very, very early on, we had very focused deliverables based on, like, customer feedback.
You built in accountability very early.
Very early.
Externally, yeah. Which is huge. This is the mistake you see people make all the time. They lock themselves away for 12 to 24 months and reemerge from their cave with this beautiful product that's completely wrong.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. I met a startup over the last couple of years that were bringing a product to market, but they were waiting to develop one component part, but it was a physical part. It was a battery, and they were waiting to go to market or to seek customers until they had that ready. And I was making the point, look, you can bring anything that looks like a battery into a meeting room with you, a demo. People don't need to see the battery working. They need to buy into the story you're telling about what the product ultimately will do.
Mm.
And that, if you, I suppose, introduce that accountability, the earlier you get customer validation, customer feedback, the better. Because, like, our product changed quite a lot from our initial concept, all in a good way, but it was based on early customer feedback based on, we like that, we don't like that, this seems to be working. And for us, we did that really, really, really early. Like, we ended up going live with our product 12 months after we started, but it was two, like, pretty large organizations, like Morgan McKinley, 1,000 people based all over the world, and Staffordshire University, 2,000 people in a university in the UK. And that was based on, I think, just getting early accountability, early customer conversations. The alternative would have been build a product in stealth ourselves and, you know, hope that we're working on the right thing.
I think as well, like, we certainly weren't walking into those meetings with nothing. Like,
yeah.
I mean, like John mentioned the story, and that was a huge part of it, but we were also showing, like, prototypes, proof of concepts. And these were, like, high fidelity. Like, these aren't, you know, Figma mockups or, you know, wireframes and things like that. These were, they felt like a real product.
Yeah.
Yes, everything was hard-coded in the background and everything like that, but it felt tangibly real. And I think when you can help somebody visualize what this would actually look like in reality, obviously, look, they know this isn't ready yet, right? But they get enough of a visual that they start to form in their mind, this is how it might work for me. And then, like, what you're looking for in those meetings is, oh, like, it would be great if, you know, and because now they're starting to think about, okay, how do I take this thing that you're showing me and actually apply it to what I need? And you're there, like, scribbling down notes.
This is going to be my next question. This is going to be the exact question. Because I love when people listen to these pods, they hear great stories, but I also want them to get tangible. So I want them to kind of go away and go, I've been doing it wrong. So you've started to answer that question already. What would you say and do in these meetings? Because I think a lot of early stage founders are like, it's nerves and it's fear because you don't want to be told no. What were you saying and showing them in these meetings?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that felt like a product.
Right.
And I think the key thing with those meetings is you're going in and, like, you don't need to be perfect. And I think that's something that I think a lot of founders struggle with, right? Is that they see their startup as, like a representation of themselves, and they don't want to go into a meeting with a prospective customer and feel like they've only got like part of the answer ready. I think, you know, a lot of organizations are more than happy to talk to you about something that's not quite fully baked yet, as long as you can visualize it for them and as long as you can show them what you're thinking. That tight feedback loop that we had, like, was incredibly important to our product development process. Like, we were, in many ways, there was a lot of luck involved as well, right? I mean, we were lucky to work with two organizations who, like, they put project teams around us within their organizations to help us to build out that first version of that product. So keeping that really tight connection with those customers ultimately allowed us to get from what was, you know, something that was held together with sticky tape in the background, but looked okay, to something that could actually be rolled out, you know, to a global organization like Morgan McKinley or a university. So it's, I think a lot of it is confidence as well, you know, confidence in your ability to execute. And I think, you know, that's something that, kind of going back to the co-founder thing, I think we had that confidence, right? We've worked together for 7 years at Core HR. We knew that we complemented each other's skill sets. Like, John knew if we needed to build something in product, I'd figure out a way of making it happen. I knew that if we needed to do something to keep a customer happy, John would figure out how to make that happen. We had what we needed. So we had the confidence that, like, no matter what comes out of the conversation with the customer, we'll be able to make this happen. And I think prospective customers really pick up on that. Whereas if you're going in kind of standoffish because you're worried about, you know, hey, my product isn't fully baked yet,
you don't want them to peep behind the curtain.
Yeah. I think you have to expose yourself a little bit, because you'll get found out if you don't, right? So it's, I think, like John said, if you wait until it's all ready to go, you'll only find out that it's actually really not when you eventually do make it to market and you realize that all these customers actually need something slightly different to what you've actually built, right? So
you did all this in 12 months. How did you do that? Was it still the two of you? Were you out there hunting customers and you were in the back end coding furiously? How did it work?
I think you just described it.
Spoiler alert.
I was out hunting customers and Joe was building, right?
We used to have this running joke that, like, we would just send John up and down on the Cork to Dublin train over and over again, because every time that John went on the train from Cork to Dublin or coming home, he would meet a prospective customer. So he'd meet randomly, like, a HR director in, you know, a large multinational would be sitting next to John on the train and he'd be demoing Workvivo to them.
Meanwhile, John is going down the aisle looking at all the pre-booked seats going, name, LinkedIn, name, LinkedIn, name.
You actually don't know how close to the mark that is.
It's cheaper than going to the Web Summit.
Yeah, but do you know what? I think, like, we weren't shy about, like, asking for meetings and asking for, look, we're building this thing. We've this idea. Can we share it with you? Like, we did so much of that, reached out to people, just asked for a meeting, right? Mm-hmm. Just to show them what we were building. And, like, there's only a very small percentage of that, like, comes to anything, but a percentage does. And, like, we met some great customers in very just situations. I don't know, it could be a lunch on the train, whatever it was, but, I did a lot of demos on the mobile, on the train, and in, you know, various situations where you're just looking for a meeting, right? And then you're asking for people for introductions. And I think you have to do that. Like, we did a huge amount of that in the first 12 months, where, it's like the early customer or prospect. And it does, like, some of them didn't become customers, obviously, but you're still getting very valuable feedback. We ultimately had a product built within 12 months based on that, like, accountability deadlines to the prospects that we were working with. When we were ready to go live, like, two very significant organizations, you know, live with our product, we didn't even have a website. So this was a thing. We always said that we would see how many years we could last without building a website.
I love this. Because generally, that's the first thing. Let's get a cool logo on a website.
Yeah, let's get a cool logo on a website. No, we didn't. We had this idea that when we launched our website, it would include video testimonials from customers.
I love that.
And that's where we worked back from. So two testimonials, two quality video testimonials from customers would be on the first website when we launched, and we were working back from that. So when Stafford University, ultimately, like, a lot of hard work, got them live, hugely successful, same with Morgan McKinley, In parallel, then we were like getting the videos produced, both of them signed up to do those testimonials, and they were very powerful. So when we launched 12 months after we'd formed, we felt like a bigger company because the website was talking about a great product that had got customer validation. We knew there was customers successfully using it. We had customer testimonials up there. Two customers, like you would think that's representative of, you know, a bigger customer population.
Yeah, they're just the two that did it.
They're just the two that we picked, right? But there were our only two customers at the time.
I love that, working backwards. I think that's such a hack. Before we move off this, what was the criteria? You talked about the criteria of do's and don'ts when you were doing it. Can you share some of those? Because I think that's really powerful for how people think about starting.
I think the biggest do for us was speed. And I think we talked about speed all of the time. And almost like before we started, when we were listing the criteria that I mentioned earlier, you know, around, okay, it has to be a SaaS product, has to be pre-existing competition. But speed was the one thing that we both agreed we had to have. So everything we did was, you know, meet a prospect, talk about something that might be great in the product. And, you know, 2 weeks later, we're back and we're showing them. And it's not prototype. It's like it's in the product. And I suppose for me, I was lucky Joe has the capability to build product at serious pace. So I think we always put ourselves under pressure for, okay, let's have this done by next week. Let's have this done by, and it just, I think we've continued that culture in the company, thankfully. It's like we definitely, I suppose we don't buy into the, your roadmap is a 3-year thing. And it's like, for us, it's like, okay, what are we doing this quarter? What's next quarter? But we've built a very healthy culture of delivering product at pace. And I think that's been there from the start.
Yeah. And I think it actually stems from like when we were at Core HR, like we had that kind of speed of execution piece in there as well. And it allowed us to compete with companies like, you know, many multiples the time or the size of the business that we were part of. So it was like a superpower. You know, being able to deliver, you knew you were competing against slow moving beasts, where if, you know, a customer gave that company a bit of feedback, you were going to, like, they were going to be waiting a year, 2 years before they might see the actual output of that, you know. And then if you're there on the other side of the of it and you're able to deliver that in a week or 2 weeks, it's totally game changing. And I mean, we definitely saw that become a superpower for Workvivo.
How do you bake that in? Because I think that's class, and you see that in massive organizations that are super successful, Amazon, Tesla, SpaceX, they all work to these like in almost insane inverted commas deadlines. How do you keep that as you grow from 2 to 10 to 12? How do you go with that?
I think one thing that helped us, and we do, like, we had a scenario where, like, very early in, I suppose, in the company, we landed ourselves in an opportunity for one of the biggest technology firms in the world. And we ended up getting to the last six there. We'd only 5 people in the company at the time, right? Last 6, last 3, down to the last 2. And we were in the last 2, and we were actually up against Facebook, their workplace product. So we'd 5 people in our company. They had, like, how many? I think it's like
20,000 or something.
Yeah, I think it's about 90,000 Facebook overall now, right? But, and we were down to the last 2. So we're competing against them. We're over in Silicon Valley, doing bake-offs, and like 40% of our company was there, right? It was myself and another guy, Kieran. And we, when we demoed the product and we were in the sessions, we took note of, like, mostly positive feedback. They also had feedback on, it's missing this, we'd love to have this, or it would be great if it had that. And I remember we left San Francisco on a Thursday afternoon after doing a morning demo. And on Friday morning, we released a video back to the customer saying, hey guys, great to meet you yesterday. We're back in Ireland now. Thanks for the feedback, Jim, on that feature. The good news is overnight, we've been able to do that. The second feature you talked about, we've also done that. Sarah, thanks for your feedback. We've done that as well. The other features you mentioned, we're going to work through the weekend. We'll have those on Tuesday. And it just became this, like, insane delivery at pace, listening to the customer, delivering on it. But we tell that story to new employees as well. And it's become a famous story in the company. And it sets, for us, it sets the tone of, look, this is how we want to respond. And we didn't, like, we won that opportunity, right? It was like they placed a bet on a 5-person company, which was insane. But it gave us the credibility then to bounce on from there. But I think that culture, you can plan 6 months to do something, or you can plan 2 weeks. And the product, the ultimate product you come up with after 6 months, it's probably not going to be a whole lot better than what you produce in 2 weeks. But you have to have the right culture supporting it as well.
Poor Joe, sitting at home going, what?
I don't work any other way, to be honest with you. It's, but no,
you said we do what? When?
I think a lot of companies are guilty of like implementing process way too early as well. You know, when I think a lot of founders, you know, look for inspiration in, you know, like the big successful companies, like some of the ones you mentioned, the likes of Spotify, the likes of these companies, right? And they've come up with these amazing processes for how they build software, for how they, you know, support their customers, all of this. They've had to come up with those processes because of their scale and their size. So like trying to emulate that when you're, you know, a tiny startup company with, you know, a handful of people, it just doesn't make any sense. And it's like, it's even the same within product. Like, you know, you see a lot of companies, like all those big tech companies, they use this kind of technology infrastructure like called microservices. And then you see all these startup founders trying to build technology the exact same way, even though it makes no sense whatsoever, because you don't have the problems yet that can actually help solve. I know we talk about this every so often as well. It's like, it's like premature optimization of things, right? It's like you're solving imaginary problems. Yeah.
You're doing the 1% when 80% is still hanging out the back.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, why are you focused on these things where like any work that you do is actually not going to convert into anything other than a process that's actually going to slow you down when you could just be, you know, building or, you know, doing whatever it is that you need to do.
This comes back to your earlier point though about experience and having known what you don't want to do. I think that's crucially important. There's this myth of the founder of being this like 18-year-old prodigy who just came out of the womb coding, just intuitively knew, oh, this is just how it works. When in reality, it's through the process you outlined earlier of, no, don't like that. That definitely doesn't work. We shouldn't do that because of X.
Exactly. I mean, there are plenty of examples out there of that 18-year-old prodigy who builds something amazing, but I think they're outliers, right? It's like for the vast majority of people, it's much more about, you know, being agile about how you build your company and responding to, you know, if you go to the market and there's signals there telling you that, hey, what you're building maybe isn't exactly right and you might need to change it a little bit, like knowing to respond to that and actually to adapt your products and to adapt your company to fit that.
What was the very first idea you had? You said you went out to Morgan McKinley with that. What was that and what did it become?
You mean the idea that we didn't follow through on? So that was, we were going to become the Uber of recruitment. So it was, the whole idea was we would build a recruitment platform where freelance recruiters based anywhere in the world, working from home, this is pre-COVID as well, so it would have been very relevant, working from anywhere, could look on this platform, see positions that companies were trying to fill and grab them, you know, as in, I'm taking this one. But a company on the other side could put their positions up. They could filter, say, it's saying, hey, I want to go with 4-star recruiters or above, so it's all based on ratings. But essentially, you would have a freelance recruiter working anywhere who's filling positions, right? Working to fill those positions. A lot more cost effective. The technology was a key differentiator for us as well. Like we had in our prototypes, we'd built in like video interviews. It was almost like swipe left, swipe right on candidates if you liked them. The concept was very, like would have been a very slick technology solution. The reason we didn't proceed with it was we started interviewing potential freelance recruiters and it kind of brought it home to us that, okay, so if we want to go live in Liverpool or Manchester or San Francisco, we're going to have to seed it with freelance recruiters that we trust. And it just felt like, okay, this feels like a lot of heavy lifting to get quality freelance recruiters that we trust to get it off the ground. And ultimately, we came back to, do you know what? That we kind of lose control there a little bit. Mm. And we need to bring it back to just the software that we've got more control of the quality of what we output and more control over the quality of what ultimately the customer experience is. And that's why we didn't go ahead with it.
Distribution is always huge. People have these great ideas for products. Oh, wouldn't that be class if... the thing you outlined there, distribution. How do you get it to people?
Yeah, but I think it would have been successful. I think if we had committed to it, I think we would have done a really good job with it. And I think the technology solution that we had prototyped was very, very, very slick and would have been a differentiator. It boils down to, like, I suppose you can do anything you want, but you can't do everything, right? And it felt like what we ultimately jumped into was a better fit for us, and we could be more successful with that.
At what point did you go, okay, we're going to change?
It was probably like not more than two months in, because I think we were impatient as well to like start working on something, right? Mm. And Joe was building prototype software, but like we wanted to be working on something that ultimately we felt, yeah, this is it. And I think 2 months in, we were looking at the whole area of engagement, what makes a difference in terms of employee engagement, what helps shape the culture of a company, how do you get people emotionally bought into what the company's trying to do. And the more we started researching it and talking about it, the more we realized we're actually really into this. Both of us personally were academically interested in it and personally interested in it. And it just immediately felt right. And then we started looking at, okay, what things make a difference? Recognition makes a huge difference. Communication makes a huge difference. Like, people are much more likely to be bought into what the company is about if they feel informed about what's going on in the company. They have a greater sense of ownership. Things like community, how do you build community into the organization and facilitate the natural communities that exist in the organization, which if you do, you're much more likely to have an engaged organization. So we started looking at these concepts, these pillars, like recognition, like communication, like measurement of engagement. And ultimately, we just started trying to design those things into a product. And it literally became a whiteboard exercise out in Douglas in Cork, where here are the components we want to build into a product. How do we design a product around them? How do we build them in? And it was just Joe and myself, whiteboard, trying to do that. And ultimately what fell out of that design process was WorkVivo. A lot of iterations in between, but that's ultimately how it started.
I think as well, like, a lot of it comes back to kind of gut feel as well, right? And I think, you know, especially when you probably have the luxury of experience, you get to develop a strong gut feeling. And funny enough, I probably trust John's gut feeling more than I even trust my own gut feeling at this stage. But I think, you know, when something is right, and both of us had that feeling about that original idea, there was just something that wasn't sitting comfortable for both of us. And the more and more we started to go down the engagement road and to explore it and look at the research behind it and all of that, we could just feel the energy is right. This is where we're supposed to be. This is the playing field that we're supposed to be in. And I think, you know, knowing to trust our gut and say, okay, look, we've done a lot of work on this other thing, but in the greater scheme of things, it's not that much work, right? So like, it's not a big deal for us to, like, we'll look back and regret it if we don't trust our gut now and it turns out to have been the wrong decision. And as John said, not just because it could have been successful, but, you know, I think both of us, we probably wouldn't have been as happy building it, and it wouldn't have actually delivered on those original objectives of starting this thing in the first place, which was to actually really enjoy what we were doing.
How do you keep an open mind, though? Because some people get very emotionally attached to these things. They go, this is it. And they'll just steer down this wrong path.
I think you have to leave emotions out of it as much as you can, right? I think like the emotion side of things, I think, is important when you think about, like, am I enjoying it, right? But as, like, I remember, I saw Ray Nolan speaking at an event here in Cork years ago, and somebody asked him a question, and they're like, he'd said something about like selling shares in one of his early companies, kind of early on. And obviously those shares would have gone on to be worth significantly more later on. And somebody like, how could you do it? How could you sell part of your baby? And I'm not sure if we're going to curse on here, but...
curse away.
But Ray said, it's like, it's a company. It's not a fucking baby. And it's like, you know, it's I think people get too emotionally attached. And it's like, you need to think about things a little bit like more. It is a business, right? At the end of the day, it's a business and you want to enjoy it. You want to have fun. You want to do all of those things. But I think if you get too emotionally attached, I think it's a dangerous place to be, because I think you run the risk of going into a situation with a customer where a customer tells you, I don't like it. This doesn't work for me. And, you know, you slaved over it for the last, you know, number of weeks building this thing. And ultimately the customer doesn't like, if you're precious about it, then like, it's not going to work, right? Because you have to be responsive. Like, I mean, we even early on, I mean, there'd be times when I'd spend a lot of time building something and I'd bring it in and show it to John and he'd always let me down gently, right?
But, this is why I asked you this question. I was like, I want to kind of talk to the guy who's in behind coding here, because I'm sure it's a lot of man hours.
So John would know how to approach it with me, right? He'd know to kind of come in softly and say, that's just like just something.
You're right? Looking great today, but...
Yeah, and he'd bring in the coffee and, you know, but he'd know, like, and you know, at first you might be like, oh, I've just spent loads of time doing this thing and it's like, I don't want to spend more time doing it again. But, you know, you'd know he's right. Like, he's spotting something. That it's funny because, like, I'm the tech and product guy, right? But John is like an incredibly strong eye for good product. Like, he knows what good looks like when it comes to product. So again, it comes back to that trusting, right? It's like, if John tells me, hey, something's not right here, like, I trust it because I know he sees these small little things. And it's funny, it could be something like that, you know, your average engineer would look at and go, oh my God, like, really? It's like, it's 2 pixels out to the right and you want me to move? Like, what difference does it make? And you may not have a customer screaming at you saying, hey, this doesn't look right, because they mightn't perceive that specific thing as being wrong. But it's like, when a lot of these little things add up, then, you know, that creates a kind of an overall perception that I think is really important, right? So, so yeah, I think you can't be precious about your product. Like, your product is going to evolve. It might change completely in terms of what it does over time based on what you're hearing from customers, what you're hearing from the market. And yeah, as Ray said, it's not a baby, it's a company.
I love how you guys take such a rational, logical approach to it. You take all emotion out of it. But was there a moment where you're like, oh, I think we're on it. I think we've hit it after these months of kind of like tweaking and whiteboarding. I think we've kind of hit the jackpot here. Was there a moment or a series of events that happened where you're like, we're going, this is it?
I think there were many moments, Gary, to be honest with you. Like, there's like milestones. Like, we've been lucky enough to have like so many milestones that we've enjoyed. Like, your first customer contract, like, that was a pinch me moment, right? When Morgan McKinley ultimately signed as a customer, that was a real pinch me moment. It's like, okay, we have a customer who's willing to pay money for our product. Like, there's something here, right? And then, you know, when you hire your first employee, because we actually had 4 customers, and one of them, like, not insignificant customers as well, the likes of Voxpro, 3,000 people based in the US, Philippines, Ireland, and there was only 2 of us in the company.
Double the amount of customers than staff.
Yeah. I think we joked at one point how far we could take it just the two of us. We hiring our first employees, like, huge milestone for us. Then you win like one of the largest tech companies in the world, like, massive milestone, and even being selected above Workplace by Facebook for that was an incredible like boost of confidence for us. And then, like, we got to meet Eric Yuan from Zoom. We showed Eric our product. He wanted to become an investor. We didn't ask him to become an investor. And it's like, oh my God, that's another pinch me moment. It's like, Eric Yuan from Zoom wants to invest in our company, you know, based on.
How had you guys funded this to now?
We, very early on, we became a HBSU. So we had some initial funding.
So anyone not familiar, high potential startup in EI, what does that mean?
It means that, I suppose, EI have recognized you as a high potential startup, and they then become willing to invest. I think it was up to $250,000. I think it might be a bit more than that now. So we had some private investment, $250,000. We had Enterprise Ireland's $250,000 investment. We had Eric, who became an investor. And that's how we funded it initially. But I think the very early days, actually the first year, we funded it on very little, where we were not taking anything out of the company. We started with a little bit of like seed funding, very small, but we had very little cost, right? And we were paying ourselves like next to nothing. We didn't spend money on it unnecessarily. And I suppose we were looking to win customers to get that additional funding, right? It wasn't, early on, it wasn't about, oh, let's build an impressive investment deck, right? It was, for us, it was like, let's build an impressive product, win customers, and on the back of that, yeah, you can start looking at an investment or whatever. But I think we were just like very, very, very lean at the start. And I think we actually thought we were going to bootstrap the company at one point indefinitely. And
what changed?
What changed? I think a couple of things changed. Eric becoming an investor was significant. And I think, you know, at the time, we were spending a bit of time over in Silicon Valley, meeting Eric, meeting prospective customers, meeting some customers we had signed. And I think you get, for me, there's a huge energy that comes from Silicon Valley and the companies that have gone a certain way over there. And I remember one conversation with Eric, it was like, how many sales guys have you got? You know, you're not going to conquer the world based on, you know, you need to consider a bigger investment. And ultimately, when we were weighing up, would we go for a bigger investment and do a Series A? The decision point was, if no matter what, if we go for a Series A, we're signed up for an adventure here, right? Mm. And it's going to take us to places where we would not get to on a bootstrapped approach. And I think that's what ultimately we signed up for is, yeah, let's go for it. There's a huge market opportunity. But it was almost a road not taken, right? Bootstrap versus, but I think taking the bootstrapped, like DNA, Core HR was a very much a bootstrapped company. I think taking that into Workvivo was very healthy as well in terms of, like, I think the way to go now, investors look for you to be capital efficient. That wasn't the case over the last few years, but we've always taken a very capital efficient approach and very sensible approach to growing the company, which I think has served us well.
Just give people some perspective, because it sounds like this is a long-term company in terms of you've been doing it for years and years and years, but you didn't start that long ago.
No, it's 5 years. We celebrated properly our 5-year anniversary in May of this year. It's like, for us, it's kind of hard to believe 5 years has passed pretty quickly. I think even like versus, I suppose, companies that we would compete against, they've all been around a lot longer than us, for sure.
Like, that's incredible growth and achievement in those 5 years, considering the origins of you two guys coming up with the whiteboard. What's next for Workvivo? What's your, I know you don't plan grand visions, but what are you working on currently? What's getting you two guys excited right now?
And a few things. I think like our product, we've got a hugely exciting vision for where we can take the product. I think right now the employee experience is one that has moved to the digital world, right? So and we think about employee experience in terms of like, what's the desired output of a great employee experience? And for us, the desired output of a great employee experience is greater emotional commitment to the organization. So if you plan and build a deliberate, great employee experience around trying to create this greater emotional commitment to the organization, lots of brilliant things happen in terms of, like, it becomes a really great place to be for employees, because it's not just for the company. Like, if employees are bought into what the purpose of the organization is about, the values of the organization, the ambition, the culture, it's a great place to work. And we're excited about, like, the fact that now has become a digital objective. Like, influencing and shaping that employee experience is largely digital. And we've built our product around trying to be the digital heart of the organization, which influences the, you know, shaping the culture and communication and bringing the purpose alive. And it's not going to change in terms of people aren't suddenly just all going to go back to the office. So the opportunity is huge. And the kind of things we're thinking about now, for next year, I think we'll just take the product to a different level again. Like it's funny, even things that over the last couple of years, like we're doing a podcast right now, right? But organizations are starting to do more and more internal podcasts because podcasts are a great way to connect to people, very intimate fireside conversation. So in a 10,000 person organization, 100,000 person organization, a leader doing a podcast that's for an internal audience is an incredible way of bringing people along.
I had this conversation with an investor on Saturday morning. I was chatting to him and he was like, oh, I'd love to, you know, interview the companies and then send that podcast out to our potential pool of investors and let them decide. I was like, that is an absolute no-brainer. I've been pitching that to people for years.
Yeah, and we've seen this. We've actually, like, we've built things like podcasting into our platform, which are, you know, things we would not have ever considered building a few years ago. But I think it probably all goes back to, look, the market is huge. We've assembled an incredible, incredible team. We've a gorgeous culture in the company. We're very ambitious. And I think for me, it's about just like realizing our potential and see where it gets us.
I've made it 50 minutes into the interview without asking you for the future of work question, but we have to touch on it. Everyone is panicking and a bit scared about, like, you know, offline, online, office, non-office. What's your views on what is happening and what will come down the road?
Yeah, I think it's funny because I think there's probably a 2-year period where, like, you couldn't go 5 minutes into a conversation without talking about the future of work.
I tried so hard to resist till now.
But I think the one thing that we have seen over the last couple of years is that, like, nobody can really predict it because it's just constantly changing. I mean, you know, we've got, like, you know, it wasn't that long ago that, like, Twitter were saying everybody could work from home. And now look at the changes that have happened in Twitter over the last week, right? So I think the reality is that, like, nobody really knows. Like, the way we look at it, like, obviously we look at it from our own perspective in terms of what kind of, like, work environment do we want to create as an employer. And for us, like, we have found that flexibility, like, remote, come into the office if you like having that flexibility has just worked really, really well. Mm. Not just for the people who work in WorkVivo, but also for us as a business, as a company. You know, I think it's helped us to build a better culture, to create an environment that people really enjoy, that kind of freedom of work. You know, we've had people who will go off and they'll travel for a week and, you know, and work from a different location, all of this. And there's an energy that kind of comes from that as well. Right.
Magic.
So, I mean, so it's worked really well for us. And I think, you know, we have no plans to kind of really change that massively. Mm. Right. I mean, like, we will, as we expand and as, you know, we hire more people in different locations, like, we will need office space and we'll need, you know, places where people can go and work. And I think, like, one thing that we definitely are seeing a lot more of is a lot more of, like, traditional office space being used as more of a collaboration space. Mm-hmm. So people, like, teams coming together that maybe are geographically dispersed, coming together more regularly to basically collaborate in person. Rather than coming in and sitting at in a cubicle for 8 hours and that kind of thing. So I think we're, like, from our perspective, we're seeing a shift in terms of, like, the purpose of the office. But I think at the same time, when you look at the wider world and you look at, you know, a lot of large organizations with, you know, changing their tune a little bit in terms of, you know, maybe it's not so much about hybrid or not so much about work from home anymore. We want to bring everybody back into the office. You know, the reality is that's going to affect how things work for everybody. I don't think we know yet. I think it's probably going to take another, 6 to 12 months before we kind of really see where things are going to settle. But yeah, I think the main thing is adapting. Like, is just adapting to the whatever that new world ends up looking like. I think, like, from our perspective, giving people choice, like, giving people flexibility is incredibly powerful. And I think it's enabled us, you know, to hire people that, you know, at an earlier stage of our journey, that we may not have been able to hire if we didn't have this advantage of being able to offer flexibility and things like that. So it's been really good to us, and I think we'll continue to do that. But yeah, as for the wider world, we can make predictions, absolutely. You know, I've made predictions in the past in terms of what way things will look like, and some of them have been good, some of them have been bad. But it's I genuinely think it's too volatile right now to be able to accurately detect like what is the way it's actually going.
It's impossible, because like you said, you couldn't have predicted this 3 years ago, you couldn't have predicted 2 years ago, 2 weeks ago, different again.
Yeah.
I love when people are honest and go, couldn't tell you. No idea. I asked one of my biggest clients a few years ago, I was like, I'd kind of been curious as how he built this thing, and he goes, I asked him how he knew that the big crash was coming because he sold a huge parcel of land just previous to it. And I was like, how did you know? And he goes, I was just lucky. He goes, couldn't tell you. And I was like, what do you think now? And he goes, couldn't tell you now either.
I think a lot of it is down to intention as well, though, right? In terms of, I think, if you rewind the clock a year and a half ago, the jobs market was incredibly competitive, so competitive, and companies were falling all over each other trying to figure out ways of attracting talent to their companies. And I think you fast forward to today and it's a very different world, right? I mean, it's obviously the environment is changing a lot. And for us, it's never been about creating an environment for the sake of creating an environment. It's not about, trying to score points over company X, right? It's actually just more about the people, right? The people who are going to come and work here, how are they going to be most effective in doing what they want to do, or what they're going to do in our company? So I think if you have the right intentions, then it doesn't really matter what the future of work looks like. It's just having the right intentions in what you're doing would be my view on it. But
I think if companies feel they have to have the staff in the office for them to work, they've hired the wrong people. Comes right back to that kind of mindset of I think you summed it up there beautifully with flexibility. It doesn't have to be strictly one or the other. Flexibility.
Yeah, I think the good thing is we're in an era now where the trust hurdle has been jumped over hugely, right? So you don't have to have a choice, or you don't have a choice in terms of you have to trust your organization, right? Trust the people to be effective working from anywhere, right? I think we've definitely always had that approach. So if the trust thing is that's a given now, right? You have to trust people to work from anywhere. Then for me, it's just about being deliberate about, why will I bring people into the office? And there is merit and value as well bringing people into the office for things like energy that people get from being in the office. But that can be once every 2 weeks, once a month, right? People I like the colleagues I work with. I think there's a general sense in our company of people like the people they work with. So when they meet up physically, there's an energy that comes from that. I think for me, it's you need to facilitate that. You need to facilitate that. Not every day. It doesn't need to be every day, but you need to facilitate it occasionally. And we talk about things like spontaneous collisions as well, right? Where you, in the physical office, it's very different to, if you're planning a day on Zoom, you know who you're going to meet for the day. I've got a podcast with Gary remotely at 11. I've got, meeting Joe at 12. So you have a list of people you're meeting for the day. You go into the office, you don't know who you're going to meet. And it's those spontaneous collisions with people are very, they're definitely, I suppose, providers of great energy. And actually we're talking about how do we facilitate those in the digital world as well. But I think for me, it's about being deliberate about using the office or using a physical location every so often, but with a purpose behind it.
A friend of mine runs a big kind of, their content house essentially in London. And they had a big, massive office and they're like, oh, this isn't really working because people want to be here or there. So what they're doing now is 6-week sprints. They've paired it back, but to a really nice office, really central. 6-week sprints, people must come in for 1 week. Everyone's in there 1 week and then 5 weeks, go wherever you want in the world. Doesn't matter. They get super clear and super specific for the week. And then every second sprint, they're going to go somewhere new. So they're going to hire a big, massive house in Lisbon or Dublin or wherever it is, and they'll mix it up that way. But I think just this flexibility and just this difference, it's exciting. I think for companies innovative like yourselves, it's exciting because it can be a competitive advantage as well to people to attract talent, like you said. We're going to finish with a quick fire round. We've never done this before, so prepare yourselves. If you're listening on audio, this will only be available on our YouTube set over there now. For people listening, where can they learn more about WorkVivo, what you guys do, and then about yourselves individually? Where's the best place to contact you?
Yeah, so about WorkVivo, like our website, workvivo.com. We're on all the social channels. We're very active on LinkedIn, on Instagram, Twitter, all the usual places. So definitely go check those out. For me personally, I'm probably most active on Twitter.
Followed you this morning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can be, I go from being very active to being inactive for a while, but when I'm active, I'm very active on it. I'm always on there, always watching what's going on. But so follow me on Twitter, on Twitch.
Your Twitch following is about to explode.
I didn't expect you to say follow me on Twitch at the end of this conversation, but
the beauty of the pod.
I'll definitely get a 5% uptick in my Twitch subscribers by the end of the show. But as John said, I do write every so often, very infrequently, but like, you know, I've pretty high a lot of opinions about things. So if you check my blog at joelennon.com, there's lots of opinions. And if you like bad language, there's a good bit of it in there as well.
Lovely. joelennon.com. For companies, I meant to ask you this earlier. What kind of companies, if they're listening, who can work with WorkVivo? Who would be an ideal client, or what kind of solution would that get?
Ideal clients, we've over 350 customers now, all shapes and sizes. We've customers that have 100 employees, which would be our smallest, right up to companies like Dollar General, who have 200,000 employees, Bupa, 100,000 employees, but we've everything in between. We've got universities, legal firms, high-tech companies, hospitals, airlines, you name it. It's every type of organization. I suppose the beauty is every organization has the challenge of trying to create that digital heart, communicating, connecting, engaging with employees. So no matter what the size, I think once you get to a certain size, and for us, it's like once you get to 100 people, that's where WorkVivo becomes very relevant.
I love that phrase, digital heart. Where can people learn more about you, John?
I'm older than Joe, so...
Write your letter.
I'm usually the one who brings that up, not him, but...
I'm older than Joe, so LinkedIn is where you'll find me mainly.
I love LinkedIn. It's very powerful. Listen, John, Joe... from WorkVivo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.